south old front riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we continue reading from The Log of a Cowboy, a narrative of the old trail days by Andy Adams. The Log of a Cowboy is an autobiographical account of a five-month drive of 3,100 cattle from Brownsville, Texas to the Blackfeet Indian Agency in Montana in 1882 along the Great Western Cattle Trail. So far in our story, Andy and his crew of cowpokes have brought their Circle Dot herd across the Rio Grande from Mexico, dealt with rustlers, struggled to contain multiple stampedes, negotiated with Indians, labored through a quicksand crossing, and barely survived carousing in the wide-open cattle town of Dodge City, Kansas. The cattle drive north from Dodge went well until they encountered Big Boggy Creek, just below the Solomon River. With cowhands from two other drives, they constructed a timber and sod bridge over which 9,000 cattle are driven over a two-day period. En route from Nebraska, the boys bet enthusiastically on a race between one of their speedy cow horses and an apparent old nag, a bet decisively lost. After being relieved of all of their money and most of their possessions, the crew moved on to the rowdy trail town of Ogallala. Their drive west was then uneventful until encountering the North Platte River. Joining another large herd, they spent several days trying to negotiate a crossing. Their crossing appeared triumphant when the foreman of the other herd suddenly drowned. Wade Scholar was the third among his family to die in such a manner, and the tragedy shook the outfit. They are now driving the two herds west toward Fort Laramie. I remind you that our stories are usually edited for recording. The two herds were held together that night. After they had grazed a few hours the next morning, the work of cutting out hours commenced. With a double outfit available, about 20 men were turned into the herd to do the cutting, the remainder holding the main herd and looking after the cut. The morning was cool, everyone worked with vim, and in 2 hours the herds were separated. Campbell, the temporary foreman of Wade Scholar's herd, would not move until he could communicate with the head office and hoped to send a message over the military wire. When his outfit had finished retrimming our herd, the two outfits bade each other farewell, and our herd started its journey. The unfortunate accident at the ford had depressed our feelings. The farewell songs generally used in parting with a river which had defied us were omitted. The herd trailed out like an immense serpent, guided and controlled by our men as if by mutes. Long before noon, we passed out of sight of 40 islands, and in the next few days, the gloom gradually lifted. We were now bearing due north and passing through delightful country. To our left ran a range of mountains, while on the other sloped the apparently limitless plain. Scarcity of water was beginning to be felt, for the streams which had no source in the mountains had dried up weeks before. There was a gradual change in the air, too, for we were rapidly gaining altitude. The heat of summer was now confined to a few hours at noonday, while the nights were almost too cool for comfort. About 3 days out from the North Platte, the mountains disappeared. There appeared a rugged-looking country, which we knew to be the Black Hills. Another day's drive brought us into the main stage road connecting the railroad with the mining camps, which nestled in those rocky hills to our right. The stage road followed the trail some 10 to 15 miles before we parted with it on a dry fork of the Big Cheyenne River. There was a roadhouse and stage stand where these two thoroughfares separated, one to the mining camp of Deadwood, while our Montana cattle trail bore for the Powder River to the northwest. We learned that some 20 herds had already passed by to the northern ranges, and that after the next fork of the Big Cheyenne, we should find no water until we struck the Powder River, a stretch of 80 miles. The keeper of the roadhouse informed us that this droughty stretch was unusual, this being one of the driest summers since the discovery of gold in the Black Hills. Here was a new situation, an 80-mile dry drive. It was 15 miles to the last water from the stage stand. There were several dry forks of the Cheyenne beyond, but we could not hope for water in their dry bottoms. The situation was serious, but other herds had crossed this arid belt since the streams had dried up, and our Circle Dots could walk with any herd that had ever left Texas. The wisdom of mounting us well reflected the good cow sense of our employer. We felt easy in regard to our mounts, though there was not a horse or a man too many. In summing up the situation, Jim Flood, our foreman, said, "We've got this advantage over the Indian Lake Drive. There's a good moon and the days are cool. We'll make 25 miles a day, as this herd has never been put to a test to see how far they could walk in a day. They'll do their sleeping at noon, and if we get any sleep, we'll do the same. Every day's drive is a day nearer the Blackfoot Agency." We made dry camp that night on the divide between the roadhouse and the last water, and the next forenoon reached the south fork of the Big Cheyenne. The water was not running, but there were several long pools, and we held the cattle there until every hoof had been thoroughly watered. McCann filled every keg and canteen. Flood had exercised caution to buy an extra keg and a bull's-eye lantern at the roadhouse. After watering, we trailed out 4 to 5 miles and camped for noon, but the herd were allowed to graze until they lay down for their noonday rest. As the herd passed, we cut a fat 2-year-old stray heifer and killed her for beef, for the inner man must be fortified for the journey before us. After a 2-hour siesta, we threw the herd on the trail. The wagon and saddle horses were held in our rear, for there was no telling when or where we would make our next halt. We trailed the herd until near evening, when the wagon went ahead to get supper. Half the outfit went along to change mounts. A half hour before the usual bedding time, the relieved men returned and took the grazing herd, and the others rode into the wagon for supper and a change of mounts. While we shifted our saddles, we smelled the savory odor of fresh beef frying. "Listen to that good old beef talking," said Joe Stallings, bridling his horse. "McCann, I'll take my carne fresco a trifle rare tonight, garnished with a sprig of parsley and a wee bit of lemon." Before we had finished supper, Honeyman rehooked the mules to the wagon, while the remuda followed. As we were starting out, Flood gave these general directions.
"I'm going to take the lead with the cook's lantern, and one of you rear men take the new bull's eye. Between the lead and the rear light, you swing men want to ride well outside, and you point men want to hold the lead cattle so the rear will never be more than a half mile behind. This is an experiment with me, but I don't see any good reason why she won't work. After the moon gets another hour high, we can see a quarter of a mile, and the cattle are so trail broke they'll never try to scatter. If it works, we'll never bed them short of midnight, and that'll put us 10 miles farther. Let's ride, lads."
By the time the herd was eased back on the trail, the cattle led out as if walking on a wager. After the first mile, the men on the point were compelled to ride in the lead if we were to hold them within the desired half mile. The men on the other side were gradually widening until the herd must have reached fully a mile in length. We swing riders were never out of sight of each other, and it would have been impossible for cattle to leave the herd unnoticed. In moonlight, the trail was plain as day. After an hour, Flood turned his lantern over to one of the point men and rode around the herd to the rear. From my position near the middle of the swing, I was as much at sea as anyone as to the length of the herd. The foreman appealed to me as he rode the column to know the length of the herd, but I could give him no more than a simple guess. But I could assure him that the cattle had made no effort to drop out and leave the trail. Within a short time, someone in the lead wigwagged his lantern. It was answered by a light in the rear, and the next minute the old rear song. Yippee lago, go long little doggy, you'll make a beef steer by and by. When that song reached us, we knew the rear cattle were being pushed forward. The distance between the swingmen gradually narrowed, from which we could tell the leaders were being held, until several times cattle grazed out from the herd due to the checking in front. Flood galloped around the herd a second time. As he passed us, I appealed to him to let them go in front, as it now required constant riding to keep the cattle from leaving the trail to graze. When he passed up the opposite side, I could distinctly hear the men on that flank making a similar appeal, and shortly afterwards, the herd loosened out, and we struck our old gait for several hours. Trailing by moonlight was a novelty. In the stillness of those splendid July nights, we could hear the point men chatting across the lead in front. In the rear, the rattling of our heavily loaded wagon and the whistling of the horse wrangler to his charges reached our ears. The swing men were scattered so far apart that there was no chance for conversation. But once in a while, a song would be started. As it surged up and down the line, every voice, good, bad, and indifferent, joined in. Singing is supposed to have a soothing effect on cattle, though none of our circle dots stopped to listen to our vocal efforts. The herd was traveling so nicely that our foreman hardly noticed the passing hours. About midnight, the singing ceased, and we were nodding in our saddles and wondering if they in the lead were never going to throw off the trail. Presently, we overtook the rebel, holding the lantern and turning the herd out of the trail. It was after midnight, and within another half hour, we had the cattle bedded down within a few hundred yards of the trail. 1 hour guards were the order of the night. As soon as our wagon and saddle horses came up, we stretched ropes and caught our night horses. These we tied to the wagon wheels or picketed nearby, and then sought our blankets for a few hours' sleep. It was 3:30 in the morning when our guard was called. The first signs of day were visible in the east. But before the watch had ended, Flood and the last guard came to our relief, and we pushed the sleeping cattle off the bed ground and started them grazing forward. Before the sun was high enough to dry the grass, we'd put several miles behind us. When the sun was about an hour high, the wagon and saddle horses passed on up the trail, and it was evident that breakfast would be served in the dining car ahead. After the sun was up, the cattle grazed freely for several hours. When we sighted the remuda 2 miles in our lead, Flood ordered the herd lined up for a count. The rebel was a reliable counter, and he and our foreman rode forward and selected the crossing of a dry wash for the counting. On receiving their signal to come on, we allowed the herd to graze slowly forward, gradually pointing them into an immense V. As the point of the herd crossed the dry arroyo, we compelled them to pass in a narrow file between the two counters, when they again spread out fan-like and continued feeding. The count confirmed the success of driving by night, and on completion, all but 2 men rode to the wagon for breakfast. By the time the morning meal was disposed of, the herd had come parallel with the wagon, but a mile westward. As fast as fresh mounts could be saddled, we rode in small squads to relieve the herders and to turn the cattle into the trail. It was a little after 8 in the morning when the herd was trailing out on the Powder River Trail. We'd already put over 30 miles of the dry drive behind us, and so far, neither horses nor cattle had been put to any extra exertion. The wagon followed, and for 3 hours we held the trail without a break. Upon sighting a divide in front, the foreman sent the wagon around the herd with instructions to make the noon camp well up on the divide. We threw the herd off the trail within a mile of this stopping place and allowed them to graze, while two-thirds of the outfit galloped away to the wagon. We allowed the cattle to rest until mid-afternoon. All hands, with the exception of two men on herd, slept in the shade of the wagon. When the cattle had had several hours' sleep, the want of water made them restless, and they began to graze away. Then all hands were aroused, and we threw them back on the trail. The heat of the day was over. We trailed a 3-mile clip until the twilight, and again threw the herd off to graze. By our traveling and grazing gaits, we could form an idea as to the distance we had covered. The consensus opinion was that we had killed over half the distance. The herd was beginning to show the want of water, but the lack of water was more noticeable amongst our saddle horses. A horse subsisting on grass alone weakens easily, and riding made them all the gaunter. When we caught our mounts that evening, we had used 8 horses to the man since we had left the South Fork, and another one would be required at midnight or whenever we halted. We made our drive the second night with more confidence, but there were times when the train of cattle must have been nearly 2 miles in length. We bedded the herd about midnight. At the break of day, the fourth guard with the foreman joined us on watch, and we started the cattle again. There was a light dew, and the cattle, hungered by their night walk, went to grazing at once on the damp grass, which would allay their thirst slightly. We allowed them to scatter over several thousand acres, as we were anxious to graze them well before the sun absorbed the moisture, but every step they took was one less toward the coveted Powder River. When we had grazed forward several miles, and the sun was an hour high, the wagon failed to come up, which caused our foreman some uneasiness. Another hour passed, and still the wagon did not come up, nor did the outfit. Soon, Moss Strayhorn overtook us, and reported that over 40 of our saddle horses were missing. On account of my ability as a trailer, Flood dispatched me to assist Honeyman in recovering the missing horses, instructing someone else to take the remuda, and the wagon and horses to follow the herd. By the time I arrived, most of the boys had secured a change of horses. I caught up my Grulla for the hunt which confronted us. McCann gave Honeyman and myself an impromptu breakfast and 2 canteens of water. We wrestled a couple of cans of tomatoes and buried them in a cache near the campground, where we would have no trouble in finding them on our return. As the wagon pulled out, we mounted and rode back down the trail. Billy Honeyman understood horses and volunteered that we would have a long ride overtaking the missing saddle stock. The absent horses were principally the ones which had been undersaddled the day before, and a tired, thirsty horse will go miles for water. He recalled that while we were asleep at noon the day before, 20 miles back, the horses had found quite a patch of wild sorrel and didn't want to leave it. Satisfied that this would hold them for several hours, we struck a free gait. After we passed the point where the mules had been overtaken, the trail of the horses was distinct enough to follow in an easy canter. We saw frequent signs that they left the trail to graze, but only for short distances, when they would enter it again for miles. Shortly before noon, as we gained the divide above our camp of the day before, about 2 miles distant, we saw our missing horses feeding on wild sorrel and other species of sour plants. We rounded them up, and finding none missing, we secured a change of mounts. The only 2 of my horses had both been under saddle the afternoon and night before, and were as gaunt as rails. Honeyman had 1 unused horse of his mount in the hand. Taking down our ropes, we halted the horses and began riding slowly around them, forcing them into a compact body. I had my eye on a brown horse of Flood's that had not had a saddle in a week, and told Billy to fasten to him if he got a chance. This was in violation of custom, but if the foreman kicked, I had a good excuse to offer. Honeyman was left-handed and threw a rope splendidly. As we circled around the horses on opposite sides, we whirled our lariats and made casts simultaneously. The wrangler fastened to the brown I wanted, and my loop settled around the neck of his unridden horse. As the band broke away from our swinging ropes, a number of them ran afoul of my rope. I gave the rowel to my gula, and we shook them off. When I returned to Honeyman, and we had exchanged horses and were shifting saddles, I complimented him on the long throw he had made in catching the brown. I mentioned that I had read of vaqueros in California who used a 65-foot lariat.
"Hell," said Billy in ridicule, "there wasn't a man ever born who could throw a 65-foot rope, except down a well."
The sun was overhead when we started back to overtake the herd. About 2 p.m., we sighted a band of saddle horses and a wagon camped a mile forward. On coming near enough, we saw at a glance that it was a cow outfit, and after driving our loose horses a good push beyond their camp, turned and rode back to their wagon.
"We'll give them a chance to ask us to eat," said Billy to me, "and if they don't, they'll miss a hell of a good chance to entertain hungry men."
But the foreman proved to be a Bee County Texan, and our doubts did him injustice. Although dinner was over, he ordered his cook to set out something to eat. They'd met our wagon, and McCann had insisted on their taking a quarter of our beef, so we fared well. The outfit was from a ranch near Miles City, Montana, going down to receive a herd at Cheyenne. The cattle had been bought at Ogallala, and this wagon was going down with their ranch outfit to take the herd on its arrival. They'd brought along 75 saddle horses, though, in buying the herd, they had also taken its remuda of 100 saddle horses. The foreman informed us that they had met our cattle in the forenoon, nearly 25 miles out from Powder River. After we had satisfied the inner man, we lost no time, as we could see a long ride ahead of us. As we rode through their remuda to cut out a few of our horses which had mixed, I knew over a dozen of their horses by the ranch brands, while Honeyman also recognized quite a few. Though we felt a pride in our mounts, we had to admit that theirs were better. The effect of climate had transformed horses that we had once ridden in southern Texas. It is a fact that a horse, having reached the years of maturity in a southern climate, will grow half a hand taller and carry 200 pounds more flesh when he has undergone the rigors of several northern winters. We halted at our night camp to change horses and to unearth our cached tomatoes. It was so late in the day that the sun had lost its force. We increased our gait until the sun was scarcely an hour high, yet we never sighted a dust cloud in our front. About sundown, we called a few minutes' halt. After eating our tomatoes and drinking the last water, we again pushed on. Twilight faded into dusk before we reached a divide, which we had had in sight for several hours, and from which we hoped to sight the timber on Powder River. As we put mile after mile behind us, that divide seemed to move away like a mirage. The evening star had been shining for an hour before we sighted the campfire of our outfit 5 miles ahead. We fired several shots on seeing the light, in the hope that they might hear us and wait. We knew they would start the herd with the rising of the moon. When we reached camp about 9 at night, everything was in readiness, the moon having risen. Our shooting had been heard, and horses for a change were tied to the wagon wheels, while the remainder of the remuda was under herd. The runaways were thrown into the horse herd while we bolted our suppers. Flood had ridden that afternoon to the Powder River to get the lay of the land. He'd found it to be 10 to 12 miles distant, and the water in the river barely knee-deep to a saddle horse. Beyond it was a fine valley. Before we started, Flood rode in and said to Honeyman,
"I'm going to send the horses and wagon ahead tonight. You and McCann camp on this side of the river, under the hill and just a few hundred yards below the ford. Throw your saddle horses across the river and build a fire, so we'll have a beacon light to pilot us in case the cattle break into a run on scenting the water. The herd'll get in a little after midnight. After crossing, we'll turn her loose just for luck."
It did me good to hear the foreman say the herd was to be turned loose. I'd been in the saddle since 3 o'clock that morning, had ridden over 80 miles, with 10 more in sight. Honeyman would complete the day with over 100. We let the remuda take the lead, so that the wagon mules could be spurred to their utmost in keeping up with the loose horses. Once they were clear of the herd, we let the cattle into the trail. They had refused to bed down. They were uneasy with thirst, but the cool weather had saved them serious suffering. We all felt gala as the herd strung out on the trail. Before we halted again, there would be water for our dumb brutes and rest for ourselves. There was lots of singing. "There's one more river to cross," and "Roll, Powder, Roll," were wafted on the night air to the coyotes that howled on our flanks, or to the prairie dogs as they peeped from their burrows. The lights which flickered in our front and rear must have been jack-o'-lanterns or will-o'-the-wisps to these occupants of the plain. Before we had covered half the distance, the herd was strung out over 2 miles. Flood rode to the rear every half hour or so, and showed no inclination to check the lead and give the sore-footed rear guard a chance to close up the column. An hour before midnight, we saw a light low down in our front, which gradually increased until the treetops were distinctly visible, and we knew that our wagon had reached the river. On sighting this beacon, the long yell went down the column, and the herd walked as only long-legged, thirsty Texas cattle can when they scent water. Blood called all the swingmen to the rear, and we threw out a half-circle skirmish line covering a mile in width, so far back that only a glimmer of the lead light could be seen. The trail struck the Powder on an angle. Within a mile of the river, the swing cattle left the deep-trodden paths and started for the nearest water. The left flank of our line encountered the cattle as they reached the river and prevented them from drifting upstream. The point men abandoned the leaders within a few hundred yards of the river, and then the rear guard of sore-footed cattle came up. The two flanks of horsemen pushed them across the river until they met. Then we turned and galloped into camp, making the night hideous with our yelling. The longest dry drive of the trip had been made, and we felt jubilant. We stripped bridles and saddles from our tired horses. Unrolling our beds, we were soon lost in well-earned sleep. The stars may have twinkled, and voices of the night may have whispered to us, but we were too tired for poetry or sentiment. The tramping of our remuda, as they came trotting up to the wagon the next morning, and Honeyman's calling, "Horses! Horses!" brought us to the realization that another day had dawned. McCann had stretched the ropes of our corral, for Flood was dead to the world. But the tramping of 140 horses and mules, crowded inside the ropes, brought him into action as well. We had had 5 hours sleep, while our mounts had been transformed from gaunt animals to round-barreled saddle horses that struggled or artfully dodged the lariat loops which were being cast after them. After securing our mounts, we breakfasted before looking after the cattle. It took less than an hour to round up and count them, and turn them loose to graze. Those of us not on herd returned to the wagon, and our foreman instructed McCann to make a 2 hours' drive down the river and camp for noon. After seeing the wagon safely beyond the rocky crossing, we hunted up a good pool to take a much-needed bath. There were trails on either side of the Powder. Our course was northwest, so we remained on the west side and grazed down it. It was a beautiful stream, having its source in the Bighorn Mountains. For the next 4 to 5 days, we had easy work. There were range cattle through that section, but fearful of Texas fever, their owners gave the Powder River a wide berth. With the exception of holding the herd at night, our duties were light. We caught fish and killed grouse, and it seemed a holiday after our experience of the past few days. During the evening of the second day, we crossed the Crazy Woman, a clear mountainous fork of the former river, nearly as large as the parent stream. Once or twice, we encountered range riders and learned that the Crazy Woman was stock country, a number of beef ranches being located on it, stocked with Texas cattle. Somewhere near the Montana line, we took a left-hand trail. Flood had ridden it until satisfied that it led to the Tongue River and the country beyond. While large trails followed down the Powder, their direction was wrong for us, as they led towards the Badlands and lower Yellowstone country. On the second day, after taking the left-hand trail, we encountered rough country and passing across a saddle in a range forming the divide between the Powder and Tongue Rivers. We were nearly a whole day crossing it, but had a well-used trail to follow, and made camp that night on a creek which emptied into the Tongue. The roughness of the trail was well compensated for, as it was a paradise of grass and water. We reached the Tongue River the next afternoon, and found it similar to the Powder, clear as crystal, swift, and with a rocky bottom. As these were minor rivers, we encountered no trouble in crossing, the greatest danger being to our wagon. On the Tongue, we met range riders again. We learned that this trail, which crossed the Yellowstone at Frenchman's Ford, was in use by herds bound for the Musselshell and remoter points on the upper Missouri. We learned that the first herd of the present season were cattle wintered on the Niobrara in western Nebraska, whose destination was Alberta. This herd outclassed us in penetrating northward, though they had not traveled half as far as our Circle Dots. After following the Tongue River several days and coming out on that immense tributary to the Yellowstone, the trail turned northwest. It was a short day's drive to the Rosebud River, and after following it a few miles, bore off again on the same quarter. In our rear hung the mountains with their sentinel peaks. In our front stretched the valley tributary to the Yellowstone, in extent an inland empire. The month was August, and with the exception of cool nights, no complaint could be made. That rarefied atmosphere was a tonic to man and beast, and there was pleasure in the primitive freshness of the country. On leaving the Rosebud, 2 days' travel brought us to the East Fork of Sweet Grass with a swift current. In the first 2 hours after reaching it, we crossed it half a dozen times, following the grassy bottoms, shifting from one bank to the other. When 40 miles from Frenchman's Ford on the Yellowstone, the wagon went down a bank into the bottom of the creek. The left hind wheel collided with a boulder in the water, and every spoke in the wheel snapped off. McCann never noticed it, but poured the whip into the mules, and when he pulled out on the opposite bank, left part of his wheel in the creek. The herd was in the lead at the time. When Honeyman overtook us and reported the accident, we threw the herd off to graze, and half the outfit returned to the wagon. When we reached the scene, every spoke was hopelessly ruined. Flood took in the situation at a glance. He ordered the wagon unloaded and the reach lengthened, took the axe, and, with the rebel, went back to a thicket of lodge poles which we had passed higher up the creek. While the rest of us unloaded the wagon, McCann, who was swearing by both note and rhyme, unearthed his saddle from amongst the other plunder and cinched it on his high wheeler. Soon our foreman and priest returned, dragging from their pommels a 30-foot pole as perfect as the mast of a yacht. We knocked off all the spokes not already broken at the hub of the ruined wheel. After jacking up the hind axle, we attached the crutch. By cutting a half notch in the larger end of the pole, so that it fit over the front axle, lashing it there securely, and allowing the other end to trail on the ground, we devised a support on which the hub of the broken wheel rested, almost at normal height. There was sufficient spring to the pole to obviate jolt or jar, and the arrangement distributed the load to relieve it of serious burden. Then we lashed a tire and fellow to the front of the wagon, and with the loss of but a couple of hours, our commissary was again on the move. The trail followed the sweet grass down to the Yellowstone. Wherever there were creeks to ford or extra poles on hills, half a dozen of us would drop back and lend a hand with our saddle pommels. The gradual decline of the country to the river was in our favor, and we should reach the ford in 2 days, where we hoped to find a wheelwright. In case we did not, our foreman thought he could effect a trade for a serviceable wagon, as ours was new and the best make in the market. Flood rode ahead to Frenchman's Ford, and late in the day returned with the information that the ford was quite a pretentious frontier village. There was a blacksmith and a wheelwright in the town. The wheelwright assured Flood that the wheel could be filled in a day, so he decided to move within 3 or 4 miles of the ford and lie over a day for repairing the wagon and have our mules reshod. We moved up the next morning. After unloading the wagon, half the outfit accompanied the wagon into the ford. They were to return by noon, when the remainder of us were to see the sights of Frenchman's Ford. The horse wrangler remained behind to accompany the other half of the outfit in the afternoon. The herd was no trouble to hold, and after watering about the middle of the afternoon, 3 of us went into camp and got dinner. As this was the first time since starting that our cook was absent, we enjoyed the opportunity to practice our culinary skills. Pride in ability to cook was a weakness in our craft. The work was divided between Joe Stallings, John Officer, and myself. Honeyman was excused on agreeing to wrestle the wood and water. Stallings prided himself on being an artist in making coffee, and while hunting for the coffee mill, found a bag of dried peaches. Said Joe, "I'll bet McCann hauled this fruit 1,000 miles and never knew he had it amongst all this plunder. I'm going to stew a saucepan full, just to show his royal nibs that he's been thoughtless of his borders." Officer volunteered to cut and fry the meat, for we were eating stray beef now with great regularity. The making of the biscuits fell to me. Honeyman soon had a fire so big that you could not have got near it without a wet blanket on. When my biscuits were ready for the Dutch oven, Officer threw a bucket of water on the fire, remarking, "Honeyman, if you was QC Segundo under me and built such a big fire for the chef, there would be trouble in camp. You may be a good horse wrangler for a Texas outfit, but when it comes to playing second fiddle to a cook of my accomplishments, well, you don't know salt from wild honey. A man might as well try to cook on a burning haystack as on a fire of your building." When the fire had burned down, the cooks got their utensils upon the fire. I had an ample supply of live coals for the Dutch oven, and dinner was shortly afterwards announced as ready. After dinner, Officer and I relieved the men on herd, but over an hour passed before we caught sight of the 1st and 2nd guards returning from the ford. They were men who could stay in town all day and enjoy themselves. But, as Flood had reminded them, there were others who were entitled to a holiday. When Bob Blades and Fox Quarternight came to our relief, they attempted to detain us with a description of Frenchman's Ford, but we cut all conversation short by riding away.
"We'll just save them the trouble and go see for ourselves," said Officer, as we galloped along.
We lost little time in changing mounts. Then all set out to pay our respects to the mushroom village on the Yellowstone. Those who had returned were clean-shaven and brought the report that a shave was 2 bits and a drink the same price. The town struck me as something novel, 2/3 of the habitations being of canvas. Immense quantities of buffalo hides were drying or baled, waiting transportation to navigable points on the Missouri. Large bull trains were encamped on the outskirts. Many such outfits were in town, receiving cargoes or discharging freight. The drivers lounged in the streets and thronged the saloons and gambling resorts. The population was mixed, and every language could be heard on the streets. The men were fine types of the pioneer, buffalo hunters, freighters, and plainsmen, though hardly as picturesque as a modern artist would paint them. For natives, there were typical specimens of northern Indians, grunting their jargon amid the babble of other tongues. Squaws wandered the irregular streets in gaudy blankets and red calico. The only civilizing element were the engineers, running the survey of the Northern Pacific Railroad. Tying our horses to a hitch rack in the rear of the Buffalo Bill Saloon, we entered a rear door and lined up at the bar for our first drink since leaving Ogallala. Games of chance were running in the rear. In front of the bar were a number of small tables, around which were seated the patrons, playing for the drinks. One couldn't help but being impressed with the unrestrained freedom of the village, whose sole product seemed to be buffalo hides. Every man wore a six-shooter, and many wore two. That primitive law of nature, self-preservation, was evident in August of 82 at Frenchman's Ford. It reminded me of the early days back home in Texas, where, on rising, one buckled on his six-shooter as part of his dress. After a second round of drinks, we strolled into the front street to look up Flood and McCann and get a shave. We soon located McCann. On sighting us, placed himself at our disposal as a guide to Frenchman's Ford. He'd been all over the town, knew the name of every saloon and those of several barkeepers, pointed out the bullet holes in a log building where the last shooting scrape had occurred, and otherwise showed us the sights which we might have overlooked. A barber shop? Why, certainly. He led the way, informing us that the wagon wheel would be filled by evening, that the mules were shod, and that Flood had ridden down to the crossing to take a look at the ford. Two barbers turned us out rapidly. We continued to take in the town, strolling by pairs, and drinking moderately as we went. Flood had returned, and seemed rather convivial, and willing to enjoy the enforced layover with us. While taking a drink in Yellowstone Bob's place, the foreman called the attention of the rebel to a cheap lithograph of General Grant, which hung behind the bar. The two discussed the merits of the picture, and Priest, who was an admirer of the magnanimity as well as the military genius of Grant, spoke in reserved yet favorable terms of the general. Flood flippantly chided him on his eulogistic remarks over an officer to whom he had once been surrendered as a rebel. The rebel took the chaffing in good humor. When our glasses were filled, Flood suggested to Priest that since he was an admirer of Grant, possibly he wished to propose a toast to the general's health. "You're young, Jim," said the rebel. "If you'd gone through what I have, your views might be different. My admiration for the generals on our side survived wounds, prisons, and changes of fortune. Time has tempered my views on some things, and I don't enthuse over generals when the men of the ranks who made them famous are forgotten. Through the fortunes of war, I saluted Grant when we of the South were surrendered, but I wouldn't propose a toast or take off my hat now to any man that lives." During these comments, a stranger, who evidently overheard, rose from one of the tables and sauntered to the end of the bar, an attentive listener to the conversation. He was a younger man than Priest, with heavy black hair reaching his shoulders. His dress was a buckskin, profusely ornamented with beadwork and fringes. He was armed, as was everyone. From his languid demeanor and his smart appearance, one would classify him at passing glance as a frontier gambler. As we turned away from the bar, the stranger accosted Priest with an inquiry as to where he was from. In the conversation that ensued, the stranger, who had noticed the good-humored manner in which the rebel had taken the chiding of our foreman, pretended to take him to task for some of his remarks. But in this, he made a mistake. What his friends might safely say to Priest would be an insult from a stranger. Seeing that he would not stand his chiding, the other attempted to mollify him by proposing that they have a drink together and part friendly, to which the rebel assented. I was pleased with the favorable turn of affairs, for my trail friend had used some severe language in resenting the remarks of the stranger. I knew the temper of Priest, as did Flood and Honeyman, and we were anxious to get him away from the stranger. But as Priest and the stranger raised their glasses to drink, the stranger, holding his at arm's length, said, "Here's a toast! To General Grant, the ablest!" But the toast was never finished, for Priest dashed the contents of his glass in the stranger's face, and, calmly replacing the glass on the bar, backed across the room towards us. When half across, a sudden movement on the part of the stranger caused him to halt, but it seemed the picturesque gentleman beside the bar was only searching his pockets for a handkerchief. "Don't get your hand on that gun you wear," said the rebel, whose blood was up, "unless you intend to use it. But you can't shoot a minute too quick to suit me. What do you wear a gun for, anyhow? Let's see how straight you can shoot." As the stranger made no reply, Priest continued, "The next time you have anything to rub in, pick your man better. The man who insults me'll get all that's due him." Still eliciting no response, the rebel taunted him further, saying, "Go on and finish your toast, you patriotic beauty. I'll give you another, Jeff Davis and the Southern Confederacy." Flood, going over to Priest, said, "Come on, Paul, we don't want any trouble. Let's go across the street and have a game of California Jack." But the rebel stood like a chiseled statue, ignoring the friendly counsel of our foreman. The stranger, after wiping the liquor from his face and person, walked across the room and seated himself at the table from which he had risen. A stillness, as of death, pervaded the room, which was only broken by our foreman repeating his request to Priest to come away. But the latter replied, "No, when I leave this place, it will not be done in fear of anyone. When any man goes out of his way to insult me, he must take the consequences. And he can always find me if he wants satisfaction. We'll take another drink before we go. Everybody in the house, come up, take a drink with Paul Priest." The inmates of the place, possibly 20 who had been witness, accepted the invitation, gathering round the bar. Priest took a position at the end of the bar, where he could notice any movement on the part of his adversary, as well as the faces of his guests. Smiling on them, he said in true hospitality, "What will you have, gentlemen?" There was a forced effort on the part of the drinkers to appear indifferent, but with the stranger sitting sullenly in their rear, and an iron-gray man standing at the end of the line, hungering for an opportunity to settle differences with six-shooters, their indifference was an empty mockery. Some of the players returned to their games, while others sauntered into the street, yet Priest showed no disposition to go. After a while, the stranger walked over to the bar and called for a glass of whiskey. The rebel stood at the end of the bar, calmly rolling a cigarette, and as the stranger seemed not to notice him, Priest attracted his attention and said, "I'm just passing through here, and shall only be in town this afternoon. So, if there's anything between us that demands settlement, don't hesitate to ask for it." The stranger drained his glass at a single gulp, and with admirable composure replied, "If there's anything between us, we'll settle it in due time, as men usually settle such differences in this country. I have a friend or two in town, and as soon as I see them, you will receive notice, or you may consider the matter dropped. That's all I care to say at present." He walked to the rear of the room. Priest joined us, and we strolled out. In the street, a grizzled, gray-bearded man, who had drunk with him inside, approached and said, "You want to watch that fella. He claims to be from Gallatin country, but he isn't, for I live there. There's a pal with him, and they've got some good horses. I know every brand on the headwaters in the Missouri, and their horses were never bred on any of its three forks.
Don't give him any of the best of you. Keep an eye on him." After this warning, the old man turned into the first open door, and we crossed over to the wheelwright's shop. As the wheel would not be finished for several hours, we continued our survey of the town, and our next landing was at the Buffalo Bull. We found four of our men in a game of cards at the very first table, while Officer was reported as being in the gambling room in the rear. The only vacant table was the last one in the far corner, and, calling for a deck of cards, we occupied it. I sat with my back to the log wall of the low one-story room. On my left, and fronting the door, Priest took a seat with Flood for his partner, while Honeyman fell to me. After playing a few hands, Flood suggested that Billy go forward and exchange seats with some of our outfit so as to be near the door, where he could see anyone that entered, while from his position, the rear door would be similarly guarded. Under this change, Rod Wheat came back to our table and took Honeyman's place. We'd been playing for an hour, with people passing in and out of the gambling room, and expected shortly to start for camp, when Priest's long-haired adversary came in the front door and, walking through the room, passed into the gambling department. John Officer, after winning a few dollars, was standing alongside watching our game. As the stranger passed, Priest gave him the wink, on which Officer followed the stranger and a heavy-set companion into the rear room. We'd played only a few hands when the heavy-set man came back to the bar, took a drink, and walked over to watch a game of cards at the second table from the front door. Officer came back shortly and whispered to us that there were four of them to look out for, as he had seen them conferring. Priest seemed the least concerned, but I noticed he eased the holster on his belt forward, where it would be ready to his hand. We called for a round of drinks, Officer taking one with us, when two men came out of the gambling hall. Holding at the bar, they pretended to divide some money. They wished to have it appear they had won in the card room. Their conversation was loud and intended to distract, but Officer gave us the wink, and their ruse was perfectly understood. After taking a drink and attracting much attention over division of the money, they separated but remained in the room. I was dealing cards a few minutes later when the long-haired man emerged from the gambling hall and sauntered up to the bar and asked for a drink. After being served, he walked halfway to the door, then whirled suddenly. He stepped to the end of the bar, placed his hands upon it, sprang up, and stood upright. He whipped out two six-shooters, let loose a yell which caused a commotion, and walked deliberately the length of the counter, his attention centered upon the occupants of our table. Not attracting the notice he expected, he turned and slowly paced the bar, hurling anathemas on Texas and Texans in general. I saw the rebel's eyes, steeled to intensity, meet Flood's across the table. In that glance of our foreman, he evidently read approval. He rose rigidly with the stealth of a tiger, and for the first time that day his hand went to the handle of his six-shooter. One of the two pretended winners at cards saw the movement and sang out as a warning, "Cuidado, mucho!" The man on the bar whirled and blazed away with his two guns into our corner. I'd risen at the word and was pinned against the wall, where on the first fire a rain of dirt fell from the chinking in the wall over my head. As the others sprang away from the table, I kicked it over and came to my feet just as the rebel fired his second shot. I had the satisfaction of seeing his long-haired adversary reel backwards, firing his guns into the ceiling, and crash heavily into the glassware on the back bar. The smoke which filled the room left nothing visible for a few moments. Priest, satisfied that his aim was true, turned, passed through the rear room, gained his horse, and galloped away before any semblance of order was restored. As the smoke cleared away, and we passed forward through the room,
John Officer had one of the three partners standing with his hands to the wall, while his six-shooter lay on the floor under Officer's foot. He had made but one shot into our corner when the muzzle of a gun was pushed against his ear with an imperative order to drop his arms, which he had promptly done. The two others, who had been under the surveillance of our men at the forward table, never made a move to bring a gun into action. There had been five or six shots fired into our corner. The first double shot, fired when three of us were still sitting, went too high for effect, though Rod Wheat got a bullet through his coat close enough to burn the skin on his shoulder. The dead man was laid out on the floor of the saloon. Through curiosity, hundreds came to gaze on the corpse and examine the wounds, one above the other, through his vitals, either of which would have been fatal. Officer's prisoner admitted that the dead man was his partner and offered to remove the corpse. On turning his six-shooter over to the proprietor of the place, he was given his freedom to depart and look up his friends. As it was after sundown and our wheel was ready, we set out for camp, where we found that Priest had taken a fresh horse and started back over the trail. No one felt any uneasiness over his absence, for he had demonstrated his ability to protect himself. Truth compels me to say that the outfit to a man was proud of him. Honeyman was substituted on our guard in the rebel's place. After we were in bed, Billy said in his enthusiasm, "If that horse thief had not relied on pot shooting and had been modest and only used one gun, he might have hurt some of you. But when I saw old Paul raising his gun to level as he shot, I knew he was cool and steady, and I'd rather died right there than see him fail to get his man." And thus we conclude this exciting section of The Log of a Cowboy, a narrative of the old trail days by Andy Adams. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
That old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky and up the cloudy draw. High